consequences were eternal. He hoped against all hope that there was another chance at truth and knowledge out there somewhere. The only problem was that the ones who knew were gone. The Midpoint Motel on Washington Street, a few miles from the tiny Waukegan Airport, was tacky enough that there wasn't a waiting list. Buck Williams was pleasantly surprised they had not even raised their rates for the crisis. When he saw the room, he knew why, and he wondered what two places in the world this dive was midpoint between. Whatever they were, either had to be better. There was a phone, however, and a shower, a bed, and a TV. Run down as it was, it would suffice. First, Buck called his voicemail in New York. Nothing from this Ritz character or anything else new, so he listened to his saved message from Dirk Burton, which reminded him why he had felt it so important to get to London. Buck tapped it into his laptop as he listened. "Cameron, you always tell me this message center is confidential, and I hope you're right. I'm not even going to identify myself, but you know who it is. Let me tell you something major and encourage you to come here as quickly as possible. The big man, your compatriot, the one I call the supreme power broker internationally, met here the other day with the one I call our muckety-muck. You know who I mean. There was a third party at the meeting. All I know is that he's from Europe, probably Eastern Europe. I don't know what their plans are for him, but apparently something on a huge scale. My sources say your man has met with each of his key people and this same European in different locations. He introduced him to people in China, the Vatican, Israel, France, Germany, here, and the States. Something is cooking, and I don't even want to suggest what it is other than in person. Visit me as soon as you can. In case that's not possible, let me just encourage this. Watch the news for the installation of a new leader in Europe. If you say, as I did, that no elections are scheduled and no changes of power are imminent, you'll get my drift. Come soon, friend." Buck called Ken Ritz's machine to tell him where he was. Then he tried calling West once again and finally got through. Buck was surprised at what a relief it was to hear his father's voice, though he sounded tired, discouraged, and not a little panicky. "Everybody okay out there, Dad?"
"Well, not everybody. Jeff was here with me, but he's taken the four-wheel drive to see if he can get to the accident site where Sharon was last seen."
"Accident?"
"She was picking up the kids at a retreat or something, something to do with her church. She doesn't go with us anymore, you know. Story is, she never got there. Car flipped over. No trace of her except her clothes, and you know what that means."
"She's gone?"
"Looks that way. Jeff can't accept it. He's taking it hard. Wants to see for himself. Trouble is, the kids are gone, too. All of them. All their friends. Everybody at that retreat thing in the mountains. State police found all the kids' clothes, about 100 sets of them, and some kind of a late-night snack burning on the stove."
"Whew, boy.
Tell Jeff I'm thinking of him. If he wants to talk, I'm here." "I can't imagine he'll want to talk, Cameron, unless you have some answers."
"That's one thing I haven't got, Dad. I don't know who does. I have this feeling that whoever had the answers is gone."
"This is awful, Cam. I wish you were out here with us."
"Yeah, I'll bet."
"You being sarcastic?"
"Just expressing the truth, Dad. If you wanted me out there, it'd be the first time."
"Well, this is the kind of time when maybe we change our minds."
"About me? I doubt it."
"Cameron, let's not get into this, huh? For once, think of somebody other than yourself. You lost a sister-in-law and a niece and a nephew yesterday, and your brother'll probably never get over it."
Buck bit his tongue. Why did he always have to do this, and especially right now? His dad was right. If only Buck could admit that, maybe they could move on. He had been resented by the family ever since he'd gone on to college, following his academic prowess to the Ivy League. Where he came from, the kids were supposed to follow their parents into the business.
His dad's was trucking fuel into the state, mostly from Oklahoma and Texas. It was a tough business, with local people thinking the resources ought to all come from their own state. Jeff had worked his way up in the little business, starting in the office, then driving a truck, now running the day-to-day operations. There had been a lot of bad blood, especially since Cameron was away at school when his mother fell ill. She had insisted he stay in school, but when he missed coming home for Christmas due to money problems, his dad and brother never really forgave him. His mother died while he was away, and he got the cold shoulder even at her funeral. Some healing had occurred over the years, mostly because his family loved to claim him and brag about him once he became known as a journalistic prodigy. He had let bygones be bygones, but resented that he was now welcome because he was somebody, and so he rarely went home. There was too much baggage to reconcile completely, but he was still angry with himself for opening old wounds when his family was suffering. "If there's some kind of memorial service or something, I'll try to make it, Dad, all right?" "You'll try?" "That's all I can promise. You can imagine how busy things are at Global right now. Needless to say, this is the story of the century." "Will you be writing the cover story?" "I'll have a lot to do with the coverage, yeah." "But the cover?" Buck sighed, suddenly tired. It was no wonder. He'd been awake nearly 24 hours. "I don't know, Dad. I've already filed a lot of stuff. My guess is this next issue will be a huge special with lots of stuff from all over. It's unlikely my piece would be the sole cover article. It looks like I do have the assignment for a pretty major treatment 2 weeks from now." He hoped that would satisfy his dad. He wanted to get off and get some sleep, but it didn't.
"What's that mean? What's the story?"
"Oh, I'll be pulling together several writers' pieces on the theories behind what's happened."
"That'll be a big job. Everybody I talk to has a different idea. You know, your brother is afraid it was like the last judgment of God or something."
"He does?"
"Yeah, but I don't think so."
"Why not, Dad?" He didn't really want to get into a lengthy discussion, but this surprised him.
"Because I asked our pastor. He said if it was Jesus Christ taking people to heaven, he and I and you and Jeff would be gone too. Makes sense."
"Does it? I've never claimed any devotion to the faith."
"The heck you haven't. You always get into this liberal East Coast baloney. You know good and well we had you in church and Sunday school from the time you were a baby. You're as much a Christian as any of us."
Cameron wanted to say precisely my point, but he didn't. It was the lack of any connection between his family's church attendance and their daily lives that made him quit going to church altogether the day it became his choice.
"Yeah, well, tell Jeff I'm thinking about him, huh? And if I can work it out at all, I'll get back there for whatever he's going to do about Sharon and the kids."
Buck was grateful the midpoint at least had plenty of hot water for a long shower. He had forgotten about the nagging throb at the back of his head until the water hit it and loosened the bandage. He didn't have anything to redress it, so he just let it bleed a while, then found some ice. In the morning, he would find a bandage, just for looks. For now, he had had it. He was bone weary. There was no remote control for the TV, and no way he would get up once he stretched out. He turned CNN on low so it wouldn't interrupt his sleep, and he watched the world roundup before dozing off. Images from around the globe were almost more than he could take, but news was his business. He remembered the many earthquakes and wars of the last decade and the nightly coverage that was so moving. Now here was 1,000 times more of the same, all on the same day. Never in history had more people been killed in one day than those who disappeared all at once. Had they been killed? Were they dead? Would they be back? Buck couldn't take his eyes, heavy as they were, off the screen as image after image showed disappearances caught on home videotape. From some countries came professional tapes of live television shows in progress, a host's microphone landing atop his empty clothes, bouncing off his shoes and making a racket as it rolled across the floor. The audience screamed. One of the cameras panned the crowd, which had been at capacity a moment before. Now several seats were empty, clothes draped across them. Nothing could have been scripted like this, Buck thought, blinking slowly. If somebody tried to sell a screenplay about millions of people disappearing, leaving everything but their bodies behind, it would be laughed off. Buck was not aware that he was asleep until the cheap phone jangled so loudly it sounded as if it would rattle itself off the table. He groped for it.
"Sorry to bother you, Mr. Williams, but I just noticed you was off the phone there. While you was talking, you got a call. Guy named Ritz. Says you can call him or you can just be waiting for him outside at 6 in the morning.
"Okay, thanks.
What are you gonna do, call him or meet him?
Why do you need to know?"
"Oh, I ain't being nosy or nothing. It's just that if you're leaving here at 6, I gotta get payment in advance. You got the long-distance call and all. And I don't get up till 7.
"I'll tell you what was your name?"
"Mac."
"I'll tell you what, Mac. I left you my charge card number, so you know I'm not gonna sneak out on you. But in the morning, I'm gonna leave a traveler's check in the room for you, covering the price of the room and a lot more than enough for the phone call. You get my meaning?"
"A tip?"
"Yes, sir."
"That would be nice."
"What I need for you to do for me is slip a bandage under my door."
"I got one. You need it right now? You all right?"
"I'm fine. Not now. When you turn in. Nice and quiet-like. And turn off my phone, okay? Just in case. If I have to get up that early, I've got to do some serious sleeping right now. Can you handle that for me, Mac?"
"I sure can. I'll turn it off right now. You want a wake-up call?"
"No, thanks," Buck said, and he smiled when he realized the phone was dead in his hand. Mac was as good as his word. If he found that bandage in the morning, he would leave Mac a good tip. Buck forced himself to get up and shut off the TV set and the light. He was the type who could look at his watch before retiring and wake up precisely when he told himself to. It was nearly midnight. He would be up at 5:30. By the time he hit the mattress, he was out. When he awoke 5.5 hours later, he hadn't moved a muscle. Rayford felt as if he were sleepwalking as he padded through the kitchen to head upstairs. He couldn't believe how tired he still was after his long nap and his fitful dozing on the couch. The newspaper was still rolled up and rubber-banded on a chair where he had tossed it. If he had any trouble sleeping upstairs, maybe he would glance at the paper. It should be interesting to read the meaningless news of a world that didn't realize it was going to suffer the worst trauma in its history just after the paper had been set in type. Rayford punched the redial button on the phone and walked slowly toward the stairs, only half listening. What was that? The dial tone had been interrupted, and the phone in Chloe's dorm room was ringing. He hurried to the phone as a girl answered.
"Chloe?"
"No, Mr. Steele?"
"Yes. This is Amy. Chloe's trying to find a way back there. She'll try to call you along the way, sometime tomorrow. If she can't get through, she'll call you when she gets there, or she'll get a cab home."
"She's on her way?"
"Yeah, she didn't want to wait. She tried calling and calling, but..."
"Yeah, I know. Thanks, Amy. Are you all right?"
"Scared to death, like everybody else."
"I can imagine. Did you lose anyone?"
"No, and I feel kind of guilty about that. Seems like everyone I know lost somebody. I mean, I lost a few friends, but nobody close. No family."
Rayford didn't know whether to express congratulations or remorse. If this was what he now believed it had been, this poor child hardly knew anyone who'd been taken to heaven.
"Well," he said, "I'm glad you're all right."
"How about you?" she said. "Chloe's mom and brother?"
"I'm afraid they're gone, Amy."
"Oh, no."
"But I would appreciate your letting me tell Chloe, just in case she reaches you before she reaches me."
"Oh, don't worry. I don't think I could tell her even if you wanted me to."
Rayford lay in bed several minutes, then idly thumbed through the first section of the paper. A surprise move in Romania.
Democratic elections became passé when, with the seeming unanimous consensus of the people and both the upper and lower houses of government, a popular young businessman politician assumed the role of president of the country. Nikolai Carpathia, a 33-year-old born in Cluj, had in recent months taken the nation by storm with his popular, persuasive speaking, charming the populace, friend and foe alike. Reforms he proposed for the country saw him swept to prominence and power. Rayford glanced at the photo of the young Carpathia, a strikingly handsome blonde who looked not unlike a young Robert Redford. Wonder if he would have wanted the job had he known what was about to happen, Rayford thought. Whatever he has to offer won't amount to a hill of beans now. Chapter 7. Ken Ritz roared up to the midpoint precisely at 6, rolled down his window and said,
"You Williams?"
"I'm your man," Buck said. He climbed into the late-model four-wheel drive with his one bag. Fingering his freshly bandaged head, Buck smiled at the thought of Mac enjoying his extra $20. Ritz was tall and lean, with a weathered face and a shock of salt-and-pepper hair.
"Let's get down to business," he said.
"It's 740 miles from O'Hare to JFK, and 746 from Milwaukee to JFK. I'm going to get you as close to JFK as I can, and we're about equidistant between O'Hare and Milwaukee, so let's call it 743 air miles. Multiply that by $2, you're talking 1,486. Round it off to 1,500 for the taxi service, and we got us a deal."
"Deal," Buck said, pulling out his checks and starting to sign. "Pretty expensive taxi."
Ritz laughed. "Especially for a guy coming out of the midpoint."
"It was lovely."
Ritz parked in a metal Quonset hut at the Waukegan Airport and chatted while running through pre-flight procedures.
"No crashes here," he said. "There were two at Palwaukee. They lost a couple of staff people here, though. Weirder than weird, wasn't it?"
Buck and Ritz shared stories of lost relatives, where they were when it happened, and exactly who they were.
"Never flew a writer before," Ken said. "Charter, I mean. Must have flown a bunch of your types when I was commercial."
"Better money on your own?"
"Yeah, but I didn't know that when I switched. Wasn't my choice."
They were climbing into the Lear. Buck shot him a double take. "You were grounded?"
"Don't worry, partner," the pilot said. "I'll get you there."
"You owe it to me to tell me if you were grounded."
"I was fired. There's a difference."
"Depends on what you were fired for, doesn't it?"
"True enough. This ought to make you feel real good. I was fired for being too careful. Beat that."
"Talk to me," Buck said.
"You remember a lot of years ago when there was all that flack about puddle jumpers going down in icy weather?"
"Yeah, until they made some adjustments or something."
"Right. Well, you remember that one pilot refused to fly even after he was told to, and the public was assured everything up to that point was explainable or a fluke?"
"Uh-huh."
"And you remember that there was another crash right after that, which proved the pilot right?"
"Vaguely."
"Well, I remember it plain as day, because you're looking at him."
"I do feel better."
"You know how many of those same model puddle jumpers are in the air today?"
"Not a one.
When you're right, you're right." "But was I reinstated?"
"No.
Once a troublemaker, always a troublemaker. Lots of my colleagues were grateful, though, and some pilots' widows were pretty angry that I got ignored and then canned, too late for their husbands."
"Ouch." As the jet screamed east, Ritz wanted to know what Buck thought of the disappearances.
"Funny you should ask," Buck said. "I've got to start working on that in earnest today. What's your read of it? And do you mind if I flip on a tape recorder?"
"Fine," Ritz said.
"Dangdest thing I ever seen. Of course, that doesn't make me unique. I have to say, though, I've always believed in UFOs."
"You're kidding. A level-headed, safety-conscious pilot?"
Ritz nodded.
I'm not talking about little green men or space aliens who kidnap people. I'm talking about some of the more documentable stuff, like some astronauts have seen and some pilots.
You ever see anything?
Nope. Well, a couple of unexplainable things. Some lights or mirages. Once I thought I was flying too close to a squad of helicopters. Not too far from here, either. Glenview Naval Air Station. I radioed a warning, then lost sight of them. I suppose that's explainable. I could have been going faster than I realized and not been as close as I thought. But I never got an answer, no acknowledgement that they were even airborne. Glenview wouldn't confirm it. I shrugged it off, but a few weeks later, close to the same spot, my instruments went wacky on me. Dials spinning, meters sticking, that kind of thing.
What did you make of that?
Magnetic field or some force like that. Could be explainable, too. You know, there's no sense reporting strange occurrences or sightings near a military base because they just reject them out of hand. They don't even take seriously anything strange within several miles of a commercial airport. That's why you never hear stories of UFOs near O'Hare, not even considered.
So you don't buy the kidnapping space aliens, but you connect the disappearances with UFOs?
I'm just saying it's not like E.T. with creatures and all that. I think our ideas of what space people would look like is way too simple and rudimentary. If there is intelligent life out there, and there has to be just because of the sheer odds...
What do you mean?
The vastness of space.
Oh, so many stars and so much area that something has to be out there somewhere.
Exactly. And I agree with people who think those beings are more intelligent than we are. Otherwise, they wouldn't have made it here if they are here. And if they are, I'm thinking they're sophisticated and advanced enough that they can do things to us we've never dreamed of.
Like making people disappear right out of their clothes.
Sounded pretty silly until the other night, didn't it?
Buck nodded.
I've always laughed about people assuming these beings could read our thoughts and get into our heads and stuff, Ritz continued. But look who's missing. Everybody I've read about or heard about or knew who's now gone was either under 12 years old or was an unusual personality.
With all the people who disappeared, you think they had something in common?
Well, they've got something in common now, wouldn't you say?
But something set them apart, made them easier to snatch? Buck asked.
That's what I think.
So we're still here because we were strong enough to resist, or maybe we weren't worth the trouble. Ritz nodded.
Something like that. It's almost like some force or power was able to read the level of resistance or weakness, and once that force got sunk in, it was able to rip those people right off the earth. They disappeared in an instant, so they had to be dematerialized. The question is whether they were destroyed in the process or could be reassembled.
What do you think, Mr. Ritz?
At first, I would have said no. But a week ago, I would have told you that millions of people all over the world disappearing into thin air sounds like a B-movie. When I allow for the fact that it actually happened, I have to allow for the next logical step. Maybe they're somewhere specific in some form, and maybe they can return.
That's a comforting thought, Buck said. But is it more than wishful thinking?
Hardly. That idea and 50 cents would be worth half a dollar. I fly planes for money. I haven't got a clue. I'm still as much in shock as the next guy, and I don't mind telling you, I'm scared.
Of?
That it might happen again. If it was anything like I think it was, maybe all this force needs to do now is crank up the power somehow and they can get older people, smarter people, people with more resistance that they ignored the first time around.
Buck shrugged and sat in silence for a few minutes. Finally, he said, "There's a little hole in your argument. I know of some people who are missing who seem as strong as anyone."
I wasn't talking about physical strength.
Neither was I. Buck thought about Lucinda Washington. I lost a friend and a co-worker who was bright, healthy, happy, strong, and a forceful personality.
Well, I'm not saying I know everything or even anything. You wanted my theory? There it is.
Rayford Steele lay on his back, staring at the ceiling. Sleep had come hard and intermittently, and he hated the logy feeling. He didn't want to watch the news. He didn't want to read the paper, even knowing a new one had flopped up onto the porch before dawn. All he wanted was for Chloe to get home so they could grieve together. There was nothing, he decided, more lonely than grief. He and his daughter would have work to do, too. He wanted to investigate, to learn, to know, to act. He started by searching for a Bible, not the family Bible that had collected dust on his shelf for years, but Irene's. Hers would have notes in it, maybe something that would point him in the right direction. It wasn't hard to find. It was usually within arm's reach of where she slept. He found it on the floor next to the bed. Would there be some guide? An index? Something that referred to the rapture or the judgment or something? If not, maybe he'd start at the end. If Genesis meant beginning, maybe Revelation had something to do with the end, even though it didn't mean that. The only Bible verse Rayford could quote by heart was Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. He hoped there'd be some corresponding verse at the end of the Bible that said something like, "In the end, God took all his people to heaven and gave everybody else one more chance." But no such luck. The very last verse in the Bible meant nothing to him. It said, "The grace of the Lord Jesus be with you all. Amen." And it sounded like the religious mumbo-jumbo he had heard in church. He backed up a verse and read, "He who testifies to these things says, 'Yes, I am coming quickly. Amen. Come, Lord Jesus.'" Now he was getting somewhere. Who was this who testified of these things, and what were these things? The quoted words were in red. What did that mean? He looked through the Bible and then noticed on the spine words of Christ in red. So Jesus said he was coming quickly. Had he come? And if the Bible was as old as it seemed, what did quickly mean? It must not have meant soon, unless it was from the perspective of someone with a long view of history. Maybe Jesus meant that when he came, he would do it quickly. Was that what this was all about? Rayford glanced at the last chapter as a whole. Three other verses had red letters, and two of those repeated the business about coming quickly. Rayford could make no sense of the text of the chapter. It seemed old and formal. But near the end of the chapter was a verse that ended with words that had a strange impact on him. Without a hint of their meaning, he read, "Let the one who is thirsty come. Let the one who wishes take the water of life without cost." Jesus wouldn't have been the one who was thirsty. He would not have been the one who wished to take the water of life. That, Rayford assumed, referred to the reader. It struck him that he was thirsty, soul thirsty. But what was the water of life? He had already paid a terrible cost for missing it. Whatever it was, it had been in this book for hundreds of years. Rayford idly leafed through the Bible to other passages, none of which made sense to him. They discouraged him because they didn't seem to flow together, to refer to each other, to have a direction. Language and concepts foreign to him were not helping. Here and there he saw notes in the margins in Irene's delicate handwriting. Sometimes she simply wrote, "Precious." He was determined to study and find someone who could explain those passages to him. He was tempted to write, "Precious," next to that verse in Revelation about taking the water of life without cost. It sounded precious to him, though he couldn't yet make it compute. Worst of all, he feared he was reading the Bible too late. Clearly, he was too late to have gone to heaven with his wife and son, but was he too late, period? In the front flyleaf was last Sunday's church bulletin. What was this, Wednesday morning? 3 days ago, he had been where? In the garage. Ramey had begged him to go with them to church. He promised he would next Sunday. "That's what you said last week," Ramey had said. "Do Do you want me to fix this four-wheeler for you or not? I don't have all the time in the world.
Raimi was not one for pushing a guilt trip. He just repeated,
"Next Sunday?"
"For sure," Rayford had said. And now he wished next Sunday were here. He wished even more that Raimi were there to go with him, because he would go. Or would he? Would he be off work that day? And would there be church? Was anyone left in that congregation? He pulled the bulletin from Irene's Bible and circled the phone number. Later that day, after he checked in with Pan Continental, he would call the church office and see if anything was going on. He was about to set the Bible on the bed table when he grew curious and opened the front flyleaf again. On the first white-papered page, he saw the inscription. He had given this Bible to Irene on their first wedding anniversary. How could he have forgotten, and what had he been thinking? She was no more devout than he back then, but she talked about wanting to get serious about church attendance before the children came along. He had been angling for something or trying to impress her. Maybe he thought she would think him spiritual if he gave her a gift like that. Maybe he was hoping she would let him off the hook and go to church by herself if he proved his spiritual sensitivity with this gift. For years he had tolerated church. They had gone to one that demanded little and offered a lot. They made many friends and found their doctor, dentist, insurance man, and even country club entree in that church. Rayford was revered, proudly introduced as a 747 captain to newcomers and guests, and even served on the church board for several years. When Irene discovered the Christian radio station and what she called real preaching and teaching, she grew disenchanted with their church and began searching for a new one. That gave Rayford the opportunity to quit going at all, telling her that when she found one she really liked, he would start going again. She found one, and he tried it occasionally, but it was a little too literal and personal and challenging for him. He was not revered. He felt like a project, and he pretty much stayed away. Rayford noticed another bit of Irene's handwriting. It was labeled her prayer list, and he was at the top. She had written, "Rafe, for his salvation, and that I be a loving wife to him. Chloe, that she come to Christ and live in purity. Ray Jr., that he never stray from his strong, childlike faith." Then she had listed her pastor, political leaders, missionaries, world conflict, and several friends and other relatives. "For his salvation," Rayford whispered. "Salvation." Another $10 church word that had never really impressed him. He knew Irene's new church was interested in the salvation of souls, something he had never heard in the previous church. But the closer he had gotten to the concept, the more he had been repelled. Didn't salvation have something to do with confirmation, baptism, testifying, getting religion, being holy? He hadn't wanted to deal with it, whatever it was. And now he was desperate to know exactly what it meant. Ken Ritz radioed ahead to airports in suburban New York, finally getting clearance to touch down at Easton, Pennsylvania.
"If you're lucky, you'll run into Larry Holmes," Ritz said. "These are his stomping grounds."
"The old boxer? He's still kicking?"
Ritz shrugged. "Don't know how old he is by now, but you can bet he didn't disappear. Whoever was taking people might have got a knock on the noggin from old Larry."
The pilot asked personnel in Easton if they could arrange a ride to New York City for his passenger.
"You're joking, right, Lear?"
"Didn't mean to. Over."
"We got a guy can get him to within a couple of miles of the subway. No cars in or out of the city yet, and even the trains have some kind of a complicated route that takes them around bad sights."
"Bad sights?" Buck repeated.
"Say again,"
Ritz radioed.
"Haven't you been watching the news? Some of the worst disasters in the city were the result of disappearing motormen and dispatchers. Six trains were involved in head-ons with lots of deaths.
Several trains ran up the back of other ones. It'll be days before they clear all the tracks and replace cars.
You sure your man wants to get into Midtown?
Roger. Seems like the type who can handle it.
Hope he's got good hiking boots. Over.
It cost Buck another premium for a ride close enough to the train that he could walk the rest of the way. His driver had not even been a cabbie, nor the vehicle a cab. But it might as well have been. It was just as decrepit and unsafe. A 2-mile walk got him to the train platform at about noon, where he waited more than 40 minutes with a mass of humanity, only to find himself among the last half who had to wait another half an hour for the next train. The zigzag ride took 2 hours to get to Manhattan, and all during the trip, Buck tapped at the keys on his laptop or stared out the window at the gridlock that went on for miles. He knew many of his locally based colleagues would have already filed similar reports, so his only hope of scoring with Steve Plank and having this C publication was if his were more powerfully or eloquently written. He was in such awe of the scene that he doubted he could pull it off. At the very least, he was adding drama to his own memoirs. New York City was at a standstill, and the biggest surprise was that they were letting people in at all. No doubt many of these, like him, lived here and needed to get to their homes and apartments. The train lurched to a stop, far short of where he had been told it would reach. The garbled announcement, the best he could make out, informed passengers that this was the new last stop. Their next jog would have put them in the middle of a crane site where cars were being lifted off the track. Buck calculated about a 15-mile walk to his office and another 5 to his apartment. Fortunately, Buck was in great shape. He put everything into his bag and shortened the strap so he could carry it close to his body without it swinging. He set off at what he guessed was a 4-mile-per-hour pace, and 3 hours later, he was hurting. He was sure he had blisters, and his neck and shoulders were tired from the bag and strap. He was sweating through his clothes, and there was no way he was going to get to his apartment before stopping in at the office.
"Oh, God help me," Buck breathed, more exasperated than praying.
But if there was a God, he decided, God had a sense of humor. Leaning against a brick wall in an alley in plain sight was a yellow bicycle with a cardboard sign clipped to it. It read, "Borrow this bike, take it where you like. Leave it for someone else in need. No charge." Only in New York, he thought. Nobody steals something that's free. He thought about breathing a prayer of thanks, but somehow the world he was looking at didn't show any other evidence of a benevolent creator. He mounted the bike, realized how long it had been since he had been aboard one, and wobbled off till he found his balance. It wasn't long before he cruised into Midtown between the snarl of wreckage and wreckers. Only a few other people were traveling as efficiently as he was. Couriers on bikes, 2 others on yellow bikes just like his, and cops on horseback. Security was tight at the Global Weekly building, which somehow didn't surprise him. After identifying himself to a new desk clerk, he rode to the 27th floor, stopped in the public washroom to freshen up, and finally entered the main suites of the magazine. The receptionist immediately buzzed Steve Plank's office, and both Steve and Marge Potter hurried out to embrace and welcome him. Buck Williams was hit with a strange new emotion. He nearly wept. He realized he, along with everyone else, was enduring a hideous trauma, and that he had no doubt been running on adrenaline. But somehow, getting back to familiar territory, especially with the expense and effort it had taken, made him feel as if he had come home. He was with people who cared about him. This was his family. He was really, really glad to see them, and it appeared the feeling was mutual. He bit his lip to keep from clouding up, and as he followed Steve and Marge down the hall past his tiny, cluttered office and into Steve's spacious office conference room, he asked if they had heard about Lucinda Washington. Marge stopped in the corridor, bringing her hands to her face.
"Yes," she managed, "and I wasn't going to do this again. We've lost several. Where does the grieving start and end?
With that, Buck lost it. He couldn't pretend any longer, though he was as surprised as anyone at his own sensitivity. Steve put an arm around his secretary and guided her and Buck into his office, where others from the senior staff waited. They cheered when they saw Buck. These people, the ones he had worked with, fought with, feuded with, irritated and scooped, now seemed genuinely glad to see him. They could have no idea how he felt. "Boy, it's good to be back here," he said, then sat and buried his head in his hands. His body began to shake, and he could fight the tears no longer. He began to sob right there in front of his colleagues and competitors. He tried to wipe the tears away and compose himself, but when he looked up, forcing an embarrassed smile, he noticed everyone else was emotional, too.
"It's all right, Bucky," one said. "If this is your first cry, you'll discover it won't be your last. We're all just as scared and stunned and grief-stricken as you are."
"Yeah," another said, "but his personal account will no doubt be more compelling,"
which made everyone laugh and cry all the more. Rayford talked himself into calling the PanCon Flight Center early in the afternoon. He learned that he was to report in for a Friday flight 2 days later. "Really?" he said.
"Don't count on actually flying it," he was told. "Not too many flights are expected to be lifting off by then. Certainly none till late tomorrow, and maybe not even then."
"There's a chance I'll get called off before I leave home?"
"More than a chance, but that's your assignment for now."
"What's the route?"
"Ord to Boss to JFK.
Chicago, Boston, New York. Home when?"
"Saturday night."
"Good.
Why, got a date?"
"Not funny."
"Oh, gosh, I'm sorry, Captain. I forgot who I was talking to."
"You know about my family?"
"Everybody here knows, sir. We're sorry. We heard it from the senior flight attendant on your aborted Heathrow run. You got the word on your first officer on that flight, didn't you?"
"I heard something, but never got an official word."
"What did you hear?"
"Suicide."
"Right. Awful."
"Can you check on something for me?"
"If it's in my power, Captain."
"My daughter is trying to get back this way from California."
"Unlikely."
"I know, but she's on her way. Trying anyway. She'll more than likely try to fly Pan. Can you check and see if she's on any of the manifests coming east?"
"Shouldn't be too hard. There are precious few, and you know none of them will be landing here."
"How about Milwaukee?"
"Don't think so."
He was tapping computer keys.
"Where would she originate?"
"Somewhere near Palo Alto."
"Not good."
"Why?"
"Hardly anything coming out of there. Let me check."
Rayford could hear the man talking to himself, trying things, suggesting options.
"Air California to Utah. Hey, found her. Name Chloe with your last name?"
"That's her."
"She checked in at Palo Alto. Pan put her on a bus to some outlying strip, flew her to Salt Lake City on Air California. First time out of the state for that plane, I'll bet."
"She got on a PanCon plane. Oh, an oldie. And they took her to, oh brother, Enid, Oklahoma."
"Enid? That's never been on our routes."
"No kidding. They were overrun with Dallas's spillover, too. Anyway, she's flying Ozark to Springfield, Illinois."
"Ozark?
I just work here, Cap."
"Well, somebody's trying to make it work, aren't they?"
"Yeah, the good news is we've got a turboprop or two down there that can get her up into the area, but it doesn't say where she might land. It might not even come up on this screen because they won't know till they get close."
"How will I know where to pick her up?"
"You may not. I'm sure she'll call you when she lands. Who knows? Maybe she'll just show up."
"That would be nice."
"Well, I'm sorry for what you're going through, sir, but you can be grateful your daughter didn't get on PanCon directly out of Palo Alto. The last one out of there went down last night. No survivors."
"And this was after the disappearances?"
"Just last night, totally unrelated."
"Wouldn't that have been a kick in the teeth?" Rayford said.
"Indeed."
Chapter 8.
When the other senior writers and editors drifted back to their offices, Steve Plank insisted Buck Williams go home and rest before coming back for an 8 o'clock meeting that evening.
I'd rather get done now and go home for the night.
I know, the executive editor said, but we've got a lot to do and I want you sharp.
Still, Buck was reluctant.
How soon can I get to London?
What have you got there?
Buck filled Steve in on his tip about a major U.S. financier meeting with international colleagues and introducing a rising European politico.
Oh, man, Buck, Steve said. We're all over that.
You mean Carpathia?
Buck was stunned.
I do?
He was the guy Rosenzweig was so impressed with.
Yeah, but you think he's the one my informant is...
Man, you have been out of touch, Steve said.
It's not that big a deal.
The financier has to be Jonathan Stonegal.
I told you Carpathia was coming to address the UN, didn't I?
So he's the new Romanian ambassador to the UN? Buck said.
Hardly.
What then?
President of the country.
Didn't they just elect a leader, what, 18 months ago? Buck said, remembering Dirk's tip that a new leader would seem out of place and time.
Big shake up there, Steve said. Better check it out.
I will.
I don't mean you. I really don't think there's much of a story. The guy is young and dashing and all that, charming and persuasive, as I understand it. He had been a meteoric business star, making a killing when Romanian markets opened to the West years ago. But as of last week, he wasn't even in their Senate yet. He was only in the lower house.
The House of Deputies, Buck said.
How did you know that?
Buck grinned. Rosenzweig educated me.
For a minute there, I thought you really did know everything. That's what you get accused of around here, you know.
What a crime.
But you play it with such humility.
That's me.
So, Steve, why don't you think it's important that a guy like Carpathia comes from nowhere to unseat the president of Romania?
He didn't exactly come from nowhere. His businesses were built on Stonegal financing, and Carpathia has been a disarmament crusader, very popular with his colleagues and the people.
But disarmament doesn't fit with Stonegal. Isn't he a closet hawk?
Plank nodded.
So there are mysteries.
Some, but, Buck, what could be bigger than the story you're on?
You haven't got time to fool with a guy who becomes president of a non-strategic country.
There's something there, though, Steve. My guy in London tips me off. Carpathia's tied in with the most influential non-politician in the world. He goes from lower house to president without a popular election.
And?
There's more?
Which side of this argument are you on?
Did he have the sitting president killed or something?
Interesting you should say that, because the only wrinkle in Carpathia's history are some rumors that he was ruthless with his business competition years ago.
How ruthless?
People took dirt naps.
Ooh, Steve, you talk just like a mobster.
And listen, the previous president stepped down for Carpathia, insisted on his installation.
And you say there's no story here?
This is like the old South American coups, Buck. A new one every week, big deal. So Carpathia's beholden to Stonegal.
All that means is that Stonegal will have free rein in the financial world of an Eastern European country that thinks the best thing that ever happened to it was the destruction of Russia.
But Steve, this is like a freshman congressman becoming president of the United States in an off-election year. No vote, president steps aside, and everybody's happy.
No, no, no. Big difference. We're talking Romania here, Buck. Romania. Non-strategic, scant gross national product, never invaded anybody, never anyone's strategic ally. There's nothing there but low-level internal politics.
It still smells major to me, Buck said. Rosenzweig was high on this guy, and he's an astute observer. Now Carpathia's coming to speak at the UN. What next?
You forget he was coming to the UN before he became president of Romania.
That's another puzzle. He was a nobody.
He's a new name and face in disarmament. He gets his season in the sun, his 15 minutes of fame. Trust me, you're not going to hear of him again.
Stonegal had to be behind the UN gig, too, Buck said. You know Diamond John is a personal friend of our ambassador.
Stonegal is a personal friend of every elected official from the president to the mayors of most medium-sized cities, Buck. So what? He knows how to play the game. He reminds me of old Joe Kennedy or one of the Rockefellers, all right? What's your point?
Just that Carpathia is speaking at the UN on Stonegal's influence.
Probably, so what?
He's up to something.
Stonegal's always up to something, keeping the skids greased for one of his projects.
Okay, so he gets a businessman into Romanian politics, maybe even gets him installed as president. Who knows, maybe he even got him his little audience with Rosenzweig, which never amounted to anything. Now he gets Carpathia a little international exposure. That happens all the time because of guys like Stonegal. Would you rather chase this non-story than tie together a cover piece that tries to make sense of the most monumental and tragic phenomenon in the history of the world?
Let me think about that, Buck said, smiling, as Plank punched him.
Man, you can sure chase rabbit trails, the executive editor said. You used to like my instincts.
I still do, but you're a little sleep-deprived right now.
I'm definitely not going to London, because I've got to tell my guy.
Marge tried to reach the guy who was supposed to meet your plane. She can tell you how to get through and all that. But be back here by 8. I'm bringing in the department editors interested in the various international meetings coming here this month. You're going to be tying that coverage together, so...
So they can all hate me in the same meeting? Buck said.
They'll feel important. But is it important? You want me to ignore Carpathia, but you're going to complicate my life with, what was it, an ecumenical religious convention and a one-world currency confab?
You are short on sleep, aren't you, Buck?
This is why I'm still your boss.
Don't you get it?
Yes, I want coordination and I want a well-written piece. But think about it. This gives you automatic entree to all those dignitaries. We're talking Jewish nationalist leaders interested in one-world government.
Unlikely and hardly compelling.
Orthodox Jews from all over the world looking at rebuilding the temple, or some such...
I'm being overrun by Jews.
International monetarists setting the stage for one-world currency.
Also unlikely.
But this will let you keep an eye on your favorite power broker, Stonegal.
Right, and heads of various religious groups looking to cooperate internationally.
Bore me to death, why don't you?
These people are discussing impossibilities. Since when have religious groups been able to get along?
You're still not getting it, Buck.
You're going to have access to all these people, religious, moneyed, political, while trying to write a piece about what happened and why it happened.
You can get the thinking of the greatest minds from the most diverse viewpoints.
Buck shrugged in surrender.
You've got a point. I still say our department editors are going to resent me.
There's something to be said for consistency.
I still want to try to get to Carpathia.
That won't be hard. He's already a media darling in Europe, eager to talk.
And Stonegal.
You know he never talks to the press, Buck.
I like a challenge.
Go home and take a load off. See you at 8.
Marge Potter was preparing to leave as Buck approached.
Oh, yes, Marge said, setting down her stuff and flipping through her notebook. I tried Dirk Burton several times. Got through once to his voicemail and left him your message. Received no confirmation. Okay?
Thanks.
Buck wasn't sure he'd be able to rest at home with everything flying through his brain. He was pleasantly surprised when he reached street level to find that representatives of various cab companies were posted outside office buildings, directing people to cabs that could reach certain areas via circuitous routes. For premium fares, of course. For $30 in a shared cab, Buck was let off 2 blocks from his apartment.
In 3 hours, he would have to be back at the office, so he made arrangements with the cabbie to meet him at the same spot at 7:45. That, he decided, would be a miracle. With all the cabs in New York, he had never before had to make such an arrangement, and to his knowledge, had never even seen the same cabbie twice. Rayford was pacing, miserable. He came to the painful realization that this was the worst season of his life. He had never even come close before. His parents had been older than those of his peers. When they had died within 2 years of each other, it had been a relief. They were not well, not lucid. He loved them, and they were no burden, but they had virtually died to him years before, due to strokes and other ailments. When they did pass, Rayford had grieved in a way, but mostly he was just sentimental about them. He had good memories. He appreciated the kindness and sympathy he received at their funerals, and he got on with his life. Whatever tears he shed were not from remorse or heartache. He felt primarily nostalgic and melancholy. The rest of his life had been without complication or pain. Becoming a pilot was akin to rising to any other highly paid professional level. You had to be intelligent and disciplined, accomplished. He came through the ranks in the usual way. Military reserve duty, small planes, then bigger ones, then jets and fighters. Finally, he had reached the pinnacle. He had met Irene in Reserve Officer Training Corps in college. She had been an Army brat who had never rebelled. Many of her chums had turned their backs on military life and didn't even want to own up to it. Her father had been killed in Vietnam, and her mother married another military man, so Irene had seen or lived on nearly every Army base in the United States. They were married when Rayford was a senior in college and Irene a sophomore. She dropped out when he went into the military, and everything had been on schedule since. They had Chloe during their first year of marriage, but due to complications, waited another 8 years for Ray Jr. Rayford was thrilled with both children, but he had to admit he had longed for a namesake boy. Unfortunately, Ramey came along during a bleak period for Rayford. He was 30 and feeling older, and he didn't enjoy having a pregnant wife. Many people thought, because of his premature but not unattractive gray hair, that he was older, and so he endured the jokes about being an old father. It was a particularly difficult pregnancy for Irene, and Ramey was a couple of weeks late. Chloe was a spirited 8-year-old, so Rayford disengaged as much as possible. Irene, he believed, slipped into at least some mild depression during that time, and was short-tempered with him and weepy. At work, Rayford was in charge, listened to, and admired. He had been rated for the biggest, latest, and most sophisticated planes in the pan-continental stable. His work life was going swimmingly. He didn't enjoy going home. He had drunk more during that period than ever before or since, and the marriage had gone through its most trying time. He was frequently late getting home and at times even fibbed about his schedule so he could leave a day early or come back a day late. Irene accused him of all manner of affairs, and because she was wrong, he denied them with great vigor and, he felt, justified anger. The truth was, he was hoping for and angling for just what she was charging. What frustrated him so was that, despite his looks and bearing, it just wasn't in him to pull it off. He didn't have the moves, the patter, the style. A flight attendant had once called him a hunk, but he felt like a geek, an egghead. Sure, he had access to any woman with a price, but that was beneath him. While he toyed with and hoped for an old-fashioned affair, he somehow couldn't bring himself to stoop to something as tawdry as paying for sex. Had Irene known how hard he was trying to be unfaithful, she would have left him. As it was, he had indulged in that make-out session at the Christmas party before Ramey was born, but he was so inebriated he could hardly remember it. The guilt and nearly spoiling his image straightened him up and made him cut down on his drinking. Seeing Ramey born sobered him even more. It was time to grow up
and take as much responsibility as a husband and father as he did as a pilot. But now, as Rayford ran all those memories through his throbbing head, he felt the deepest regret and remorse a man can feel. He felt like a failure. He was so unworthy of Irene. Somehow he knew now, though he had never allowed himself to consider it before, that she couldn't in any way have been as naive or stupid as he had hoped and imagined. She had to have known how vapid he was, how shallow and, yes, cheap. And yet she had stayed by him, loved him, fought to keep the marriage together. He couldn't argue that she became a different person after she switched churches and got serious about her faith. She preached at him at first, sure. She was excited and wanted him to discover what she had found. He ran. Eventually, she either gave up or resigned herself to the fact that he was not going to come around by her pleading or cajoling. Now he knew from seeing her list that she had never given up. She had simply taken to praying for him. No wonder Rayford had never gotten that close to ultimately defiling his marriage with Hattie Durham. Hattie. How ashamed he was of that silly pursuit. For all he knew, Hattie was innocent. She had never badmouthed his wife or the fact that he was married. She had never suggested anything inappropriate, at least for her age. Young people were more touchy and flirtatious, and she claimed no moral or religious code. That Rayford had obsessed over the possibilities with Hattie, while she probably hardly knew it, made him feel all the more foolish. Where was this guilt coming from? He had locked eyes with Hattie numerous times, and they had spent hours alone together over dinners in various cities. But she had never asked him to her room, or tried to kiss him, or even hold his hand. Maybe she would have responded had he been the aggressor, but maybe not. She might just as easily have been offended, insulted, disappointed. Rayford shook his head. Not only was he guilty of lusting after a woman to whom he had no right, but he was still such a klutz he hadn't even known how to pursue her. And now he faced the darkest hours of his soul. He was nervous about Chloe. He wanted her home and safe in the worst way, hoping that having his own flesh and blood in the house would somehow assuage his grief and pain. He knew he should be hungry again, but nothing appealed. Even the fragrant and tasty cookies he thought he would have to ration had become painful reminders of Irene. Maybe tomorrow. Rayford switched on the television, not out of interest in seeing more mayhem, but with the hope of some news of order, traffic clearing, people connecting. After a minute or two of the same old, he turned it off again. He rejected the idea of calling O'Hare about the likelihood of getting in to get his car because he didn't want to tie up the phone for even a minute in case Chloe was trying to get through. It had been hours since he'd heard she left Palo Alto. How long would it take to make all those crazy connections and finally get on an Ozark flight from Springfield to the Chicago area? He remembered the oldest joke in the airline industry. Ozark spelled backward is crazo. Only it didn't amuse him just then. He leapt when the phone rang, but it wasn't Chloe. "I'm sorry, Captain," Hattie said. "I promised to call you back, but I fell asleep after the call I took and have been out ever since." "That's quite all right, Hattie. In fact, I need to. I mean, I didn't want to bother you anyway at a time like this." "No, that's okay. I just... Have you talked to Chloe?" "I'm waiting for her to call right now, so I really have to get off." Rayford had been more curt than he intended, and Hattie was, at first, silent. "Well, all right then. I'm sorry." "I'll call you, Hattie. Okay?"
"Okay."
She had sounded hurt. He was sorry about that, but not sorry that he had gotten rid of her for the time being. He knew she was only trying to help and be kind, but she hadn't been listening. She was alone and afraid, just like he was, and no doubt by now she had found out about her family. Oh, no, he hadn't even asked about them. She would hate him, and why shouldn't she? How selfish could I be, he wondered. Eager as he was to hear from Chloe, he had to risk a couple more minutes on the phone. He dialed Hattie, but her line was busy. Buck tried calling Dirk Burton in London as soon as he got home, not wanting to wait longer with the time difference overseas. He got a puzzling response. Dirk's personal answering machine ran through its usual message, but as soon as the leave-a-message beep sounded, a longer tone indicated that the tape was full. Strange. Dirk was either sleeping through it all, or... Buck had not considered that Dirk could have disappeared. Besides leaving Buck with a million questions about Stonegal, Carpathia, Todd Cothran, and the whole phenomenon, Dirk was one of his best friends from Princeton. Oh, please let this be a coincidence, he thought. Let him be traveling. As soon as Buck hung up, his phone rang. Of all people, it was Hattie Durham. She was crying. I'm sorry to bother you, Mr. Williams, and I had promised myself I would never use your home number. That's all right, Hattie. What is it? Well, it's silly, really, but I just went through something, and I don't have anybody to talk to about it. I couldn't get through to my mother and sisters, and, well, I just thought maybe you'd understand. Try me. She told Buck about her call to Captain Steele and brought him up to date on who Steele was, that he had lost his wife and son, and that she had been late calling him back after hearing her good news from Buck. And then he just brushed me off because he's waiting for a call from his daughter. I can understand that, Buck tried, rolling his eyes. How did he get into this Lonely Hearts Club? Didn't she have any girlfriends to unload on? I can too, she said. That's just it. And I know he's grieving because it's like his wife and son are dead, but he knew I was on pins and needles about my family, and he never even asked. Well, I'm sure it is all just part of the tension of the moment, the grief, like you say, and... Oh, I know it. I just wanted to talk to somebody, and I thought of you. Well, hey, any time, Buck lied. Oh, boy, he thought. My home number is definitely going to come off that next batch of business cards. Listen, I'd better let you go. I've got an evening meeting tonight myself, and... Well, thanks for listening. I understand, he said, though he doubted he ever would. Maybe Hattie showed more depth and sense when she wasn't under stress. He hoped so. Rayford was glad Hattie's line was busy, because he could tell her he had tried to call her back, but he didn't have to tie up his phone any longer. A minute later, his phone rang again. Captain, it's me again. I'm sorry, I won't keep you long, but I thought you might have tried to call me, and I've been on the phone, so... As a matter of fact, I did, Hattie. What have you found out about your family? They're fine. She was crying. Oh, thank God, he said. Rayford wondered what had gotten into him. He said he was happy for her, but he had come to the conclusion that those who hadn't disappeared had missed out on the greatest event of cosmic history. But what was he supposed to say? Oh, I'm sorry your family was left behind, too? When he hung up, Rayford sat next to the phone with a nagging feeling that he had for sure missed Chloe's call this time. It made him mad. His stomach was growling, and he knew he should eat, but he had decided he would hold off as long as possible, hoping to eat with Chloe when she arrived. Knowing her, she wouldn't have eaten a thing. Chapter 9. Buck's subconscious waking system failed him that evening, but by 8:45 p.m. he was back in Steve Plank's office, disheveled and apologetic. And he had been right. He felt the resentment from veteran department editors. Juan Ortiz, chief of the International Politics section, was incensed that Buck should have anything to do with the summit conference Juan planned to cover in 2 weeks. The Jewish nationalists are discussing an issue I have been following for years. Who would have believed they would consider warming to one world government? That they would even entertain the discussion is monumental. They're meeting here rather than in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv because their idea is so revolutionary. Most Israeli nationalists think the Holy Land has gone too far with its bounty already. This is historic.
Then what's your problem, Plank said, with my adding our top guy to the coverage?
Because I am your top guy on this.
I'm trying to make sense of all these meetings, Plank said. Jimmy Borland, the religion editor, weighed in. I understand Juan's objections, but I've got two meetings at the same time. I would welcome the help.
Now we're getting somewhere, Plank said.
But I'll be frank, Buck, Borland added. I want a say in the final piece.
Of course, Plank said.
Not so fast, Buck said. I don't want to be treated like a pool reporter here. I'm going to have my own take on these meetings, and I'm not trying to horn in on your expert territories. I wouldn't want to do the coverages of the individual meetings themselves. I want to bring some coordination, find the meaning, the common denominators. Jimmy, your two groups, the religious Jews who want to rebuild the temple and the ecumenicalists who want some sort of one-world religious order, are they going to be at odds with each other? Will there be religious Jews, Orthodox Jews at the ecumenical meeting? Because that seems at cross purposes with rebuilding the temple.
Well, at least you're thinking like a religion editor, Jimmy said. That's encouraging.
But what's your thought?
I don't know. That's what makes this so interesting. That they should meet at the same time in the same city is too good to be true.
Financial editor Barbara Donahue brought closure to the discussion.
I've dealt with you before on these kinds of efforts, Steve, she said, and I appreciate the way you let everybody vent without threat. But we all know your mind is made up about Buck's involvement, so let's lick our wounds and get on with it. If we each get to put our own spin on the coverage in our departments and have some input on the overall piece that I assume goes in the main well, let's get on with it.
Even Ortiz nodded, though to Buck he seemed reluctant.
Buck's the quarterback, Plank said, so keep in touch with him. He'll report to me.
You want to say anything, Buck?
Just thanks a lot, he said ruefully, causing everyone to chuckle.
Barbara, your monetarists are meeting right at the UN like they did when they went to the three currency thing?
She nodded.
Same place and pretty much the same people.
How involved is Jonathan Stonegal?
Overtly, you mean? She said.
Well, everybody knows he's circumspect, but is there a Stonegal influence?
Does a duck have lips?
Buck smiled and jotted a note.
I'll take that as a yes. I'd like to hang around that one, maybe try to get to Diamond John.
Good luck. He probably won't show his face.
But he'll be in town, won't he, Barbara? Wasn't he at the plaza for the duration last time?
You do get around, don't you? She said.
Well, he only had each of the principals up to his suite every day.
Juan Ortiz raised his hand. I'm going along with this, and I have nothing personal against you, Buck. But I don't believe there is a way to coordinate this story without inventing some tie-in. I mean, if you want to lead off a feature story by saying there were four important international meetings in town almost all at once, fine. But to make them interrelated would be stretching.
If I find that they aren't interrelated, there won't be an overall story, Buck said.
Fair enough.
Rayford Steele was nearly beside himself with worry, compounded by his grief. Where was Chloe? He had been inside all day, pacing, mourning, thinking. He felt stale and claustrophobic. He had called Pan Continental and was told his car might be released by the time he got back from his weekend flight. The news on TV showed the amazing progress being made at clearing the roadways and getting mass transportation rolling again. But the landscape would appear tacky for months. Cranes and wreckers had run out of junkyards, so the twisted wreckages remained in hazardous piles at the sides of roads and expressways. By the time Rayford got around to calling his wife's church, it was after hours, and he was grateful he wouldn't have to talk to anyone. As he hoped, a new message was on their answering machine, though it was communicated by a stunned-sounding male voice. You have reached New Hope Village Church.
We are planning a weekly Bible study, but for the time being, we will meet just once each Sunday at 10 a.m. While our entire staff except me and most of our congregation are gone, the few of us left are maintaining the building and distributing a videotape our senior pastor prepared for a time such as this. You may come by the church office anytime to pick up a free copy, and we look forward to seeing you Sunday morning. Well, of course, Rayford thought, that pastor had often spoken of the rapture of the church. That was why Irene was so enamored with it. What a creative idea to tape a message for those who had been left behind. He and Chloe would have to get one the next day. He hoped she would be as interested as he was in discovering the truth. Rayford gazed out the front window in the darkness just in time to see Chloe, one big suitcase on the ground next to her, paying a cab driver. He ran from the house in his stocking feet and gathered her into his arms. "Oh, Daddy," she wailed. "How's everybody?" He shook his head. "I don't want to hear this," she said, pulling away from him and looking to the house as if expecting her mother or brother to appear in the doorway. "It's just you and me, Chloe," Rayford said. And they stood together in the darkness, crying. It was Friday before Buck Williams was able to track down Dirk Burton. He reached the supervisor in Dirk's area of the London Exchange.
"You must tell me precisely who you are in your specific relationship to Mr. Burton before I am allowed to inform you as to his disposition," Nigel Leonard said. "I am also constrained to inform you that this conversation shall be taped, beginning immediately."
"I'm sorry?"
"I'm taping our conversation, sir. If that is a problem for you, you may disconnect."
"I don't follow."
"What's to follow? You understand what a tape is, do you?"
"Of course, and I'm turning mine on now as well, if you don't mind."
"Well, I do mind, Mr. Williams. Why on earth would you be taping?"
"Why would you?"
"We are the ones with a most unfortunate situation, and we need to investigate all leads."
"What situation? Was Dirk among those who disappeared?"
"Nothing so tidy as that, I'm afraid."
"Tell me."
"First, your reason for asking."
"I'm an old friend. We were college classmates."
"Where?"
"Princeton."
"Very well. When?"
Buck told him.
"Very well. The last time you spoke to him?"
"I don't recall, okay? We've been trading voicemail messages."
"Your occupation?"
Buck hesitated.
"Senior writer, Global Weekly, New York." "Would your interest be journalistic in nature?"
"I won't preclude that," Buck said, trying not to let his anger seep through, "but I can't imagine that my friend, important as he is to me, is of interest to my readers."
"Mr. Williams," Nigel said carefully, "allow me to state categorically, on both our tapes apparently, that what I am about to say is strictly off the record. Do you understand?" "Because I am aware that both in your country and in the British Commonwealth, anything said following an assertion that we are off the record is protected."
"Granted," Buck said.
"Beg pardon?"
"You heard me. Granted. We're off the record. Now where is Dirk?"
"Mr. Burton's body was discovered in his flat this morning. He had suffered a bullet wound to the head. I'm sorry, as you were a friend, but suicide has been determined."
Buck was nearly speechless.
"By whom?" he managed.
"The authorities."
"What authorities?"
"Scotland Yard and security personnel here at the Exchange."
"Scotland Yard?" Buck thought.